All right. So we're here with Pitt Harling, and we're going to talk a little bit about the Memorize deck, because why wouldn't we?
Yep.
But before we get into anything too specific, let's just maybe preface. Pitt, you have a beautiful way of talking about the Mem deck in terms of you know, energy and charging it up. And I think people would, I don't know, maybe you could give us the 1 minute kind of, if that's not too much of a challenge, like the 1 minute explanation of why you love the Mem deck so much.
Yeah, well, what I like about the Mem deck is that you have this head start. I mean, with sleight of hand, obviously, also you have this head start because you practice for years. But here you have sort of like an information head start. If people assume that the deck is shuffled, then they are already on the wrong track and you're already way ahead of them. And that, of course, can be put into good use for, transforming this energy into effect, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
And you first kind of, when were you first exposed to the Mem deck, actually? Because obviously not all of your, like card fiction, for example, a lot of that is just sleight of hand. When did it really start becoming predominant?
I think that was around 1999, something like that, or around 2000. Actually, the card fictions came to be because at that time I was so deep into Memorize deck stuff that there came the point where I had a deck in my hand, and when it was a shuffled deck, I thought, "Oh, right. How can I possibly do anything with that? Because I don't know where the card is." And then I realized, no, that's not good. That's not healthy. So, which is why I focus more on from a shuffled deck in use, so to speak. Mm-hmm. That's why card fictions came to be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of your favorite Mem deck? Obviously, feel free to mention any of your own in your own work, but obviously from the wider literature as well. What really, maybe not even like what do you use in like a corporate kind of like when you're performing because it's the best, but like what do you have the most fun when performing? Because that happens a lot with the Mem deck, where the methods are so fun that you just can't help but enjoy what you're doing.
That's true. It changes a little bit. I mean, if I've been doing this one trick for a few weeks, then usually I enjoy doing something new again. But I always find myself going back to mnemonica. No, not mnemonica, mnemonicosis. So basically just a little bit like trick that cannot be explained. You know, they name a card or they think of a card and then you try and get to it, which is sometimes called improvisation with a Memorize deck, which is a little bit of a misnomer. Because actually there are only like four or maybe five paths that you go depending on what case it is. And it's, you don't usually come up with something new every time. But that's just really fun to do because you have to still think a little bit on your feet. And the effect is just very strong and it's very, very direct and very clear. So I enjoy that a lot. And then, sometimes other tricks just because they are a little challenging. Like there's one trick in the book called Duplicity, if I can make one of my own, where you have a deck riffle shuffled and then you sort of follow the chains and deal two poker hands and you do bottom deals following the chains of how the spectator dealt in his deck. It's a bit difficult to explain, but that just feels nice in your head. Mm-hmm. So every time I'm doing that beforehand, I'm a little scared. And then when I do it, I think, that feels good.
I think another impressive one on this kind of topic of chains, which we don't really need to get into, but it's something you'll unlock once you have the Mem deck, is Sherlock, right? Because that one, I first saw somebody perform that at on a Zoom thing. I think it was in Conjurer community. Some member performed it, and I was like, where'd that come from? And then he dropped a comment in a Facebook group saying, Pitt Hartling's Sherlock. And I think that's such a beautiful innovation what you've done with that one in terms of just taking it one step further.
Yeah, that's a fun. This one is actually really easy to do, fortunately, because you just have to recite your stack in order and not much thinking there. And the idea that the principle, of course, goes back to Charles Jordan. It's actually based on something very old.
Mm. Yeah. And I'll just mention one more from your book, although I'll contradict myself and bring up another one if another one comes to me, but Catch Me If You Can, I remember reading that one, and that's an example I think of when you read the method, it's like, it's so funny, it almost feels like the Mem deck was built so you could do that.
It's a little bit of a bluff in a way, and it's a good trick to introduce a second deck. So if you do tricks with a regular deck and then bring in the second deck, it has a natural motivation because the trick uses those two decks, and then you can continue with the other deck and do some Mem deck work and save yourself a deck switch.
Mm. Well, I think that's probably enough preface on maybe more general overarching Memdex stuff. I'd wanted to quickly, I don't know what you'd call this, maybe like elevator pitch or whatever, just talk about a couple of interesting ideas, and I'd love to bounce some things around with you. We talked with a fellow magician, Stephen Bridges, recently, and we kind of came up with this idea for an effect, which, again, like I was talking about earlier, is somewhat influenced by your work in Unforgettable. And it's the idea of, I don't know, let's say you have a deck and you let the audience shuffle the entire deck, and you give the presentation, there is no presentation, but there's some justification for dealing through the deck, and you would memorize, I don't know, every third card, right? Which I know there's a lot to throw out there, or you memorize every third card, but there are methods for that, memory methods for that. And so obviously that would end you up in a situation kind of like the one you get in Unforgettable, where you have cards where it's there's four cards between every Memdex card or whatever, and you have the positions memorized. And this is after they've shuffled it, which would probably then allow you to let audiences pull out bunches of cards in a feeling chaotic but controlled manner, where they're actually pulling four cards out each. And then if you have a big group of people, they all have four cards, which would then, we were kind of contrasting and didn't know where to go with the reveal. I was saying you could do like the Chankanast kind of psychological force, and you would actually get about 70-80% of the room, which would probably be more impressive, right? Because you want to have a few miscalls in there. And then he was saying maybe you'd want to do like I think Danny Ortiz teaches it in Utopia, or kind of like a Woody Aragon love ritual thing, where everybody has their four cards and they do this, and the card at the end where you can name, or they, I don't know, some sort of, I think there must be some way of leveraging that fact that not only could you have it where you know the third card, the fourth card in position for the whole deck, but you can hand that out and split it off to individual spectators.
I see. Well, you have to find some pretext for going through the deck initially, you know, when you remember the cards, then you'd have some reason for doing that. Otherwise, it wouldn't make much sense. But yeah, interesting. Sure, yeah. I mean, people are just fascinated by those kind of multiple card locations, because I think memory is sometimes a good method to add to other sleight of hand methods. So for example, in this case, it is not just that you know one card of every packet, or for everybody you know selection, but the fact that you can remember them. So if you tell nine people what cards they selected, it feels a little bit like you couldn't have set that up in advance, or you couldn't have memorized it on the spot, because it just seems so difficult to remember so many cards. You know what I'm saying? So it feels like you really have no idea, and you must be reading their mind because you're not looking at some list or something. Because people don't realize that you can actually remember 9 or 10 cards. Or for example, very, very simple example, if you take a shuffled deck and remember the first four cards, just the first four. For example, you take the deck and you give it a quick overhand shuffle face up, and as the first four cards go by, you remember. And then you do a cutting the crossing the cut, that's how it's called, crossing the cut force or dribble force or something, and you tell somebody to go ahead and pick a card, maybe the first, second, third, doesn't matter. So if they now take the third card, it really feels like a free choice, you know what I mean? But you still know which one it is. So just adding memory in this way to existing normal technique can sometimes enhance an effect a little bit.
And I think that's
seem freer, you know, more free.
And especially even if, and this isn't the point, obviously, but if magicians are watching, even giving people the choice of, hey, oh, you have that card? Well, you can take the next one if you want, or, you know, do you want to go one more? You know, it makes it feel so free. But yeah, that's a really good point. I never even thought about that. Let's I don't want to spend too long on that one. So let's talk about this. This is interesting. So you know how a 16 card packet, obviously we have the Pharaoh Shuffle, which will do wonders for the full deck. But as you kind of, there's these multiples, right? There's 8 cards, 16 cards, 32 cards, where you can do a certain number of Pharaohs, and that will start doing interesting things. So, for example, a packet of 16, I think, is like four Pharaohs, right? There's a potential, I think, for a routine a bit like your High Noon, where, and this is the premise, maybe you can tell me if you follow. So you would have a 16 card section maybe of your mem deck, and maybe the first 16 cards you would spread it on the table. They can, I don't know, just look at one in their head, pick it. Then you would give them a free choice of, oh, how many times do you want me to shuffle the deck? And because of Pharaoh, it's cyclical, they could say like 10, and it doesn't matter because you're just going to be cycling through. And you would actually know that I'm going to end up in maybe like Pharaoh 3. And the good thing about, because this is impossible with a full deck, right? When you do all these Pharaohs, the deck changes and there's not much of a, you wouldn't be able to memorize the differential in pattern. But I think when you have 16 cards, you could memorize the differential. So for after the, and after a couple of Pharaohs and you end up in Pharaoh 3, it's actually a pretty simple pattern to remember based on your original mem deck. It just changes slightly. So then I think you'd then be able to do like your high noon kind of effect where you turn over a card, show the face, put it down, show the face, and then you'll know when it's going to be the next one just based on this new pattern.
So when they name which card they thought of, you know when it's coming? You know its position in the deck? Is that what you're saying?
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. So once they name it, but because you have this little 16-card packet, even though it's they chose how many shuffles, just because it's got that Pharaoh thing. That's I will admit I haven't really performed it much, but I think it's an interesting potential.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have maybe it's method-wise, I think it's more interesting than effect-wise. Maybe you could do
something else. Good example,
I'm not a big fan of this procedure of I keep shuffling, you tell me when to stop, because it doesn't feel so free after all. I think if you really wouldn't care, why not have them shuffle? Right. You know, it feels a little fishy to people because they see you're doing this special kind of shuffle. You know, the Pharaoh doesn't really look like the most random thing. It sometimes appears a little studied because it's quite precise. So I think people might get suspicious that there's some underlying mathematics, you know, when you shuffle and say, yeah, I can, shall I shuffle one more time or not? You know, Paul Swinford's work is full of this kind of thing. Tell me when to stop shuffling. And well, intellectually, it's good, but it doesn't feel very random and free. So maybe we'd have to find some other way to get around that.
So I think, I don't want to, maybe if you had anything else you can carry on, because I don't know if you've...
And the other thing that comes to mind is that if you're using a small packet, then obviously every card moves in a very determined way. I mean, with a Pharaoh shuffle, of course, also with a full deck, but maybe you could use it to keep track not only of one card, but of any card, really. There are some things, you know, with Alex Elmsley has the, I don't remember the name now, but the constant stack, I think it's called, where you put cards at strategic positions so that after any number of Pharaohs, you will still have only basically two states of the deck, because at every given position there will be a card of either one value or another value, but never anything than those two. So you go from state A to B and back to A and back to B concerning values, and the only thing that changes is the suits. Constant stack. And that's nice in a way, because you can throw in a Pharaoh or two at any time you want and you still have that same stack and you still have full information without having to calculate anything. But again, you never have a spectator shuffle. So, well, depends on what the effect is. It's a little bit like, you know, the stay stack, the mirror thing, Rustuck. It's also fascinating that you can, that the stack survives Pharaoh shuffles, but it's not really much use because you can still not have the deck shuffled. I mean, I think the most attractive thing to an audience would be to expose the method, to say, look, if you put cards in this mirror thing, I can shuffle them like that. And look, it's still a mirror. I mean, that might probably get the best reaction. It's the most fascinating aspect of that thing. You have to find a way to put that into an effect.
I think the key point, like you're saying, is the Pharaoh. Adrien Lacroix, I don't know if you've seen his virtual triumph, but he actually uses a Pharaoh where the spectators do it. And I wonder if that would, I don't know, something like that might help it feel at least more justified.
Another way of thinking about this is to go backwards. So instead of doing Pharaohs, you could do anti-Pharaohs. So especially with a small packet, if you have 16 cards or 8 cards, you can deal packets or have spectators quickly deal packets and then put them together in some order. That may seem a little more random than just doing tiny Pharaohs.
Actually, speaking of Pharaohs, I assume you're familiar with the expert card technique, kind of endless belts chart, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is more just an observation than anything, but I wonder if you've noticed this yourself as well, is that you can actually perform like an any card, any number effect using those endless belts. So if somebody tells you the card is, I don't know, the king of clubs, mm-hmm. number 8, which is 18, and they say they want it in position 14, mm-hmm. You can actually look in the endless belt and you'll see that, in the endless belts, like position on the first row or whatever, 17 after two pharaohs moves to 14. So mm-hmm. king of clubs is 18. If I just move one card, give it two pharaohs, it will end up in 14. So that is, I just find it really cool that you can do any cards, any numbers using pharaohs and the endless belts. But maybe that's like you said, maybe that's just more impressive just by the method. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we can just enjoy thinking about stuff and who knows where it will lead to, you know? You don't have to be commercial from the first step. I mean, sometimes it doesn't lead to anything, but then you still enjoy the journey. So why not? It may be worthwhile. There's this story where some Russian monarch visited a scientist who did early experiments with electricity, and they didn't really have applications for it yet. So the guy asked, so it's all very interesting and fascinating, but what's its use? What's it good for? And the guy apparently replied, well, Your Majesty, what use is a baby? And that puts it nicely, I think. I don't know whether it's a true story, but sort of makes sense. There's potential, you know?
Maybe. Yeah, right. Maybe I can ask you, so when it comes to like practicing that stuff, so I think I asked you this a little bit on the main podcast, but is it mostly just performing it, or is it talking with friends, or just like kind of doing maybe like a focus group, maybe your wife? I'm sure she sees quite a lot of it.
Not my wife, that's for sure. No, anything else really, just performing, trying out, playing around with it, talking about it. Yeah, all of that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. This is like, I guess. Do you kind of like not use that audience then? Because as she's seen so much of it now that she's kind of getting tired of it, or how does that like? I mean, I guess like, who do you pick as your focus groups? I mean, I guess that more like, do you just kind of go, okay? So say for instance, okay, you got a new trick, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, okay, I want to try this out, but I need to try it on like, I guess, quote unquote, real people. Will you just like put that into like your routine one night? Like, okay, look, I'm going to use this effect. Usually I do this set of routines, but okay, I'm going to slip this one in here.
Yes.
Kind of, what are your, is that kind of what you do? How do you go about, okay, I'm going to ground test this new effect? Yeah. I guess, I know I just asked that, but I guess you know what I'm trying to say.
It's a good question, an important question as well. Well, I'm lucky enough to have a couple of, well, let's say laboratories. So performing situations where I can sneak in a new thing once in a while without much danger, so to speak. So for example, in other times than currently, obviously, where we're not performing at all, but together with two friends, we have a monthly performance on board of a ship on the Main River here in Frankfurt. And we divide the audience into three parts, into three groups. And then we each do half an hour of a show, and the audience goes back to their seats to have another course of their meals. And then they rotate and go to see the next show. So we each can do our little half hour set three times a night. And that really helps to try something out. It's a little bit like performing at the Magic Castle. I mean, you can do a thing 28 times in that week when you're booked in the close-up room with four shows a night. So usually I have some set that I do. And in the last third or so, I have that blank spot where I can put anything I want. And this is where I sometimes just try out new stuff. And so I do it once. I mean, it is sort of rehearsed. It's not that it would be the first time ever that I'm doing it. I've been thinking about it and doing it at home, obviously. But anything that I notice there, the good thing is I can do it again on the same night. Like an hour later, I do the same thing for another group, and then even a third time. And usually by the end of the night, there is some insight. It may be, okay, that doesn't work, back to the drawing board, or I'll never do that again. But sometimes it's just, okay, I have to twist and tweak here a little bit and change it. And so that really helps.
Thank you. That's a really good answer. It's helpful because it's hard sometimes, you know, when we talk about this stuff, it's like, okay, yeah, you're right. When I hear what you're saying, I'm like, but how do you, I guess also you've kind of got that experience by now, right? Where you're like, okay, I've tried this sort of effect and like, 3 out of 4 times it didn't work very well. Yeah. So you kind of know that like, okay, you can't really touch that area, right? And you like,
Yeah. Well, for me, the challenge is I always, I think you have to distinguish between the performance and the routine itself. Say you do something and it for some reason it doesn't work. So now you don't know, is it the routine? Is there some flaw in the design, so to speak? Or was it the performance? Did I just don't do it well, or didn't I did it wrong, or I don't know. So there you, I think after a while you develop some intuition where the problem lies, but you still need that experiment. I mean, I've been wrong so many times, and many times I've just simplified something. So I planned like a three-phase routine, and then after a few performances I realized, no, I just do that second phase and be done with it, and that's the most impact I can get out of that. No need for elaborate additions. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes things get stronger when you first do the same thing twice, but not as strong, you know, so you keep the main strength of the method for the third phase. But if you only did that, then it's too sudden. So some things need a little build, so to speak. Yeah, that's just trial and error.
Yeah, thanks, man. I don't want to keep you too long. I do have one, potentially maybe two more quick ideas to machine gun fire at you. One of them, but let's say you're using a two decks, right? Two stacks, but they're the same stack. But so I don't know. Say you, the magician, has Pneumonica, and your spectator has Pneumonica. The only difference is that your spectator has Pneumonica, but in reverse order, right? So Nine of Diamonds is the first card, and it's face down, right, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
there was an interesting idea we had again with Stephen Bridges, where they would name any card. You know where it is in their reverse stack, which so you just adjust your own stack so that if you both dealt, you would, even though all the other cards are different, you would end up on the same one.
Yeah,
that was like the genesis. But then I think where we took it further was because when you deal cards, you also reverse them. If you, the magician, were to deal face down, but they were to deal face up, obviously it's, you know, they're dealing face up looking for their card, you're dealing face down to build tension, suspense, easily justified. You're going to be reversing your order while they're going to be maintaining. So even though at the beginning you can spread and show both the decks different, obviously maybe you want to spread like 70% of both so they don't see the full mirror, but you can show it's different at the beginning. As they're dealing down to their card face up, then they get to their card face up, you have a card face down, you show it's a match. That's like the first little climax. They quickly deal through the rest of their cards just to show, see the whole deck's different. You do the same for you. So when, by the end of it, you've dealt through all your cards face down, maintained order, they've reversed or the other way around, I can't quite remember. Which now means the stack's actually in identical order. Sure. So I'm sure now you could go into some kind of huge coincidence type effect, kind of, which is a nice follow on from the.
Well, actually, no need to reverse the order for that, because you might just offset your deck by 10 cards or so, you know,
right.
Cutting, and then you could still show that they're not in the same order. And, but yeah,
right.
Interesting idea. Sure. Yeah, sounds good.
So maybe that's one that I'll play around with. Like it's like you're saying, with there's still a little bit Genesis and not being. Audience tested.
It has a little ring of Paul Curry, you know, the power of thought, where the card is at the same position, and then see where it takes you from there. Sure.
Yeah, because I'm sure once you have that moment, you don't obviously need to reveal the climax at that match. You can probably do a couple more effects without revealing that match, and then end with a huge thing with a whole deck, kind of like Quantum Ruse, a total coincidence.
Yeah, you mean to sort of delay the climax?
Yeah, because obviously you now have like a hidden asset, right, which is that both decks are perfectly in the same stack. Yeah. They don't know that yet. They still think they're totally different. So maybe you just do, oh, let's both deal down and see where we land. And look, we're on the same card again. Oh, again. And then suddenly it's like this build, and then you like spread over the rest of the cards.
I think you'd have to find some way to get some shuffling into that, because if the effect is that the two decks match, then it needs shuffling. Because if there's no shuffling, then this kind of effect falls into that, I think. For different kinds of effects, you need different kinds of conditions, let's say. But maybe there could be some way to, possibilities.
Yeah, and I'm sure you have plenty of, you have a lot of like shuffle procedures and such in your books that I'm sure would potentially work for this.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll just mention one last thing, and this is just something that we've had a lot of fun with, kind of like and I want to credit you here while you're here, which is your quartet stuff. Like you were talking about with Pneumonicosis, where a lot of it is kind of like improvisation, but a lot of it is also predetermined. We've noticed similar patterns in quartets, where I once did something on Jacob where, he picked a random card in a different deck. I think it was like an eight. And then I asked him to choose any word at random, or I don't know, I think he said like Egypt or some random word. And obviously then you can cut the deck so that the first card of the quartet, you know, you have control over the distance of the first one based on what you cut. Yes, and sure. Then the rest of them, you can... I think I was asking him, like, oh, name one of your sisters. But I know that both his sisters are in the same sort of ballpark range of letters in their name. So then you deal to the next quartet. And then, oh, name one of your pets. He only has one pet, so but the audience don't know that. And, you know, that kind of thing. And I think you can actually do similar stuff to Pneumonicosis, but using the quartets and spelling from one to the next, using, like, identity aspects.
Interesting. It's true, yeah. Sure, you know where they are, so you might as well go to all of them. Yeah, nice.
Right. So we just wanted to say, I guess, thanks, because that's a really great routine.
Thank you.
Quartets. We've kept you here long enough, Pitt, and I'm sorry we just kind of mercilessly threw a bunch of ideas at you, but you've been very gracious, and we're glad to have you on. Thanks for your
Thank you very much. I enjoyed that a lot.